On August the 27th, a few Wednesdays ago, we had 13 people on our hill from about 8 o'clock on. It was quite an astounding night. 13 people whom I have carefully named in Flying Saucer Review's next issue, I hope, in SpaceLink, in Cosmos, in the Contact magazine Awareness, and I mention these not through blowing the trumpet of our little team at Warminster, but simply that we give names and addresses of witnesses, so important. At 9:30, Bob Strong, the ex-RAF bomber man, who's one of my little team, and Sybil, the housewife observer, set off for Star Hill, leaving 11 of us, including an ex-naval commander's wife, including her friend and neighbour, an 80-year-old person from Winchester, including a lawyer and his wife from another part of the country, Ian Cohen and his wife from Bournemouth, Chris Trubridge, who's a student violinist at the London Royal College of Music, a York student, Mr. Robert Coates, a character who called himself Diophantis from Sirius 2. He makes the claim, not I. We had a Mrs. Gwen Smith from Seattle, Washington, and we had several of our little group, Mr. Julian Butler, John Alford, myself. 13 people. When Bob and Sybil left us at 9:30, we were reduced to 11. But the point is, those people are named in the story. So essential. At 10:10 p.m. exactly, we noticed the attention of several pairs of eyes, perhaps I should say, was drawn to what one of our group described as a burning bush or a burning circle. Now, don't think I'm getting suddenly biblical or hysterical. I'm not that type. Two of the boys who are mentioned in the article rushed towards the burning bush. We followed, perhaps because we are older, we couldn't keep up with these late teenagers. But the point is that all people saw the burning bush except Bob and Sybil. And frankly, I distrusted it to begin with because I thought, well, I'm a realist, I'm a journalist. That to me savours very much of burning rubble left by the farmer. When the boys had practically reached the landing point, and this was a landing point, the rest of us on the hill, Bob and Sybil were seeing the same thing but from Star Hill, we saw a glorious ellipsoid which was very, very low, maximum altitude 100 feet. Above the lighted West Wilts Golf Clubhouse, approximately 800 yards from us, outwardly, at a point to the left of the burning bush. Then we were aware that the burning bush had disappeared. Now, this ellipsoid, which remained hovering and stationary for at least 3 minutes, according to this watch, then started to move off to our left, towards southeast, traversing Copheath, Battlespree, and Star Hill on the backward road to Devizes or Stonehenge. At one point, as it was moving off very, very sedately, very low, a beautiful golden orange colour, the radiance around it increased as soon as it moved. Nothing of Earth. it was joined by a second one which was tailing and trailing it from left to right as we viewed it, looking back from our hill. And this, because it was farther away, was much smaller. It was a dull matte white in colour. The two objects almost merged. They were going side by side, and the boys who had been out to the burning bush, Christopher Troubridge and Robert Coates, came back and they were almost hysterical. Don't say, well, Shuttlewood can come here, he can tell us what he likes, of course. He seems to have a vested interest now in Warminster. I'm an Essex man. I'm proud I live in Warminster, but I have no vested interest. Ask the 13 witnesses. Now, these lads came back, and they were so overcome by emotion and shock that they downed my quart of coffee in the space of about 5 minutes. It was some time before we could get from them what had actually happened. Remember, there was the craft stationary over the golf clubhouse. A good 3 minutes it moved off, joined by a second. Perhaps it's only coincidental that the Daily Telegraph on August the 30th, 3 days later, published a story verifying a landing at Badbury Rings in Blandford, in Dorset, our neighbouring county. The policeman and his wife, I think, were among the witnesses. You've probably seen the story. We're not cashing in on that story because ours happened on the 27th, and there's no such thing as cashing in on this subject, which is everything. The individual, nothing. The ego, nothing. The subject, everything. The boys, in stumbling words, told us that when they went out to the burning bush, when the bush was extinguished and it was an absolute circle, it wasn't, as we thought, a fire or having bush-like proportions, it was absolutely circular and exact on the ground. Precise. When they got there, they had their torches with them, obviously, and they wanted to see what had disturbed the ground. They were not prepared for the shock of seeing a figure. Obviously, in retrospect, a figure from one of the two craft, and pretty obviously, from the nearer, of course. The figure was 7 feet tall or more. Robert Coates is 6 feet 1.5 inches, which is about an inch taller than I, and he said that it was a good foot taller than he is. This was confirmed by Christopher. They shone the torch on this giant figure, a massive figure, dressed in dark skin-tight clothing, with a beautiful gold-coloured sash coming around its neck, sweeping down and around its waist. Now imagine the shock of two boys, one of whom had seen UFOs before, the other had not. Their shock, not only at seeing what we were seeing, it was very much as Mars was. We mistook it to begin with for Mars. We thought, well, how close can Mars get this object? And there was Mars, of course, still overcopied, well away to the left. The essential point is that these two boys were frightened by size of the spectacular unknown. They told us that the figure, it was a pity, really, that they ran away, because later they sensed the figure was not hostile and was not negative. It was the night of a full moon. And the overt action, quite openly undertaken by those craft and the figure, who was no more than 600 yards from our vision, where the burning bush was ignited, if you like, to have done that under those conditions, with the lighted clubhouse in rear full of golfers on the spree, over here the military at the military camp, and here us on the hill. Nothing hostile, nothing unfriendly, nothing fearful about this figure. And the boys said, do you know, it had beautiful hair, and the face was so sweet. Naturally we said, well, what sort of a face was it? Had it any hair? Was it male? Was it female? Do you know, they couldn't say whether it was male or female. All they said was, it was a beautiful face with a beautiful smile, and it seemed rather feminine. Now, I grabbed their torch and I ran across. I'm much older than they are. My knees were knocking. Of course they were. But I went across to a point quite close to where, obviously, the figure had been, and there was no one there. And in my elementary, adolescent, juvenile little way, perhaps, in which I first started to try and make contact with the people aboard these craft, with Morse code from a bulldog torch, I was flashing signals ahead of me to where the figure had been, taking a line on the bush that now wasn't a bush. And I was simply sending messages of friendship. Messages of the one power that nothing on this earth can ever fight against, love. If you have fear, you can't have love. The two don't mix. So this perhaps geared me perhaps to a slightly more brave appearance than I felt, because honestly I was shaking like a leaf. But I was thinking, well, it's such a beautiful night, conditions are so harmonious, here are 13 of us here. Why fear an unknown? Because the evidence is that whatever was there has been in our atmosphere for millennia. All the tumuli, all the barrows, all the temples, perhaps, have been erected by our brothers in past millennia as an offering to this great power, this great dimension, the love force. We call it the gods. Nothing to be seen. Now, in that emotion-charged atmosphere, and I speak very sincerely, when I got back to the group, I was so thankful that the dear old lady who is 80 had seen both objects with the naked eye. Lovely. This was beautiful to me. It was as lovely as when a person came up from Sussex and she brought 5 little children. They were all orphans, onto that hill. And it was a night when we couldn't get up there, and they stopped the night and they saw 5 beautiful little children between 7 and 10. To me, as an individual, as a humanitarian, if you like, that evidence from those young babies is far more relevant than all the evidence from the Condon atomic physicists, geologists, atomic physicists, whatever they care to call themselves. They are experts in their particular branches of science. But the essential thing is, they have never seen a UFO, so their whole report is invalid. So obvious. One has to see. And this is what we'd seen this night. But the atmosphere, of course, emotion charged. No other description. It was electrified. Coming back to the group, under those particular and perhaps peculiar circumstances, one perhaps is inclined to say unusual things. Not egotistically at all, but something tumbles from the mind to the tongue. And I simply said, don't worry, whoever was there has gone, but I've a strong feeling we shall see them later on in a different form. Silly thing to say, of course. On the face of it, ridiculous. at about 11, I think it was 11:25, we saw some peculiar clouds in a beautifully clear sky. The moon was full, the sky was perfect, the stars were lighting the heavens. Suddenly, three peculiar cloud formations. Rounded, ellipsoid, rounded-ended, but they appeared to have a density or a plasma-like quality about them which didn't really put them into the category of clouds as we know them. Difficult to describe, except to emphasize that one was suspended immobile in quite a stiff wind at that particular time, immobile in the sky over Battlesbury. The other two over, one over each of the two copse areas. And if anyone has been to Warminster, they'll know exactly where that is. A triangle. It's funny how many times the triangle shape recurs in sightings even of craft. The three craft. The ellipsoid or circular craft with three lighted points. Three, obviously, is an important cosmic, universal number. But these three clouds were quite a phenomenon in themselves. Or I should say a phenomena, as there are three. Here they appeared in a perfect sky for no obvious reason at all, but they were making us think, or they were about to make us think and use our faculties a little bit more perhaps than we have done. Two eventually disappeared, and the other became rather upended. The bottom portion broke away cleanly and formed a pyramid in shape. At times this pyramid was quite opaque, solid looking. At others one had a three-dimensional look at this, because one could see right into the interior and through this pyramid. Therefore, not a cloud. But really, what was the significance of this pyramid? If you recall, the first shots that Bob Strong ever took of these craft around Warminster, which we were very lucky, of course, to get, but very disappointed because of the absolute travesty, the transmogrification of these things, that you were not getting what you were seeing. Even with a 3-inch telescope, we were getting mainly peculiar pyramidal formations of light. When Patrick Moore, if he was in the audience, I wish he was, I'd like to see him deny this. When Patrick Moore came to our hill on the last Friday in January, not at our invitation, but of course they wanted a sensational little program, of course, and to take the mickey further out of the subject. They came, the cameramen had been to Tahiti or somewhere like that, a very exotic assignment abroad. They felt very chill, very cold on our hill. And this was at 8 o'clock. And of course, they were so sarcastic, heavy cynicism, which we're so used to by now. All of you are, of course. We've got to be. And we've got to stick together, that's so important. When they saw three objects within the space of 2 minutes, this was a little bit coincidental for satellites, even for Warminster, where we're supposed to have 50 satellites every night. And of course, the first one, I didn't say a thing, and this came over on the BBC2 broadcast about Warminster in a ridiculous sort of program which matched us, of course, and the subject, which is more important, it matched the subject with the ridiculous nonsense of the Flat Earth Society. That we all develop, the eventual evolution of man is nothing more than a glorified mummified egg, 40 feet incandescent egg on Saturn. If that's the ultimate in man's development and evolution, if I suspected that that could be, I'd go out on the beer now and leave all you. I'd go out and have a riotous life while I'm still in the flesh. Of course I would. Moore saw two objects that he was absolutely staggered by. Take my word for this. Challenge the producer of that program, Simon Campbell Jones. Challenge the cameramen who were so excited that they borrowed our binoculars to tell us what color formations were in the objects. Ask them, because the BBC irreligiously cut the very part which was most relevant. What Moore was saying about the two objects which followed the first, which he dismissed as a satellite, and described, and we wouldn't argue, of course we wouldn't. He said they are not unidentified flying objects, but they are certainly fantastic and inexplicable light formations. Fair enough. That's good enough for us. We know that there are these lights. The lights that come down to cars and do all sorts of crazy things. Hallucinated lights, if you like. These we have not yet registered on any camera. We can't record these. So therefore, their substance, or shall we say, their density is considerably different from the more material objects which we do get on film and which we can classify as absolute UFOs. Well, Moore, of course, saw, and he was intended to see. The camera team, even the clapper girl who was saying scene two, take one, and all that sort of nonsense, they were all meant to see. But of course, many people are given an opportunity. Many are called. And few have the guts to be among the chosen by telling truth. Perhaps there's something in that. The truth didn't come across then from Moore. Perhaps not of his own volition. He has a reputation, of course, and reputations are like bubbles. They are meant to be pricked at some time. Perhaps it was that the BBC considered this, oh, this is too sudden for the public, and we might antagonise the Air Ministry and other government departments. The public is not yet ready for this sort of thing. So, of course, it didn't come over. The very part that we were waiting for, that was worth missing the football on the other side for, didn't come across. Out of our hands, water under the bridge, we don't mind. We don't judge. But 13 people having this experience, the only one who, of the 11 on our hill, who missed the pyramid shape, most amazing, this transmutation and transformation of apparent cloud. Most amazing. Unforgettable, even at Warminster. I say this with great reverence and humility. Because it must mean something very significant. The only one who missed it was a dear old lady who'd driven a long way all that day, and we'd been up, of course, quite a bit of the night already. She fell asleep at the wheel of her car and missed all this. But she didn't miss the landing, and she clambered over the gate with the best of us to get to that point, the burning bush. Now, this is, you see, the whole subject is such, as any one of you must know. It's a subject which, throughout, has been fraught with a crank fringe. And I don't just mean the crank religionists who balance on that end of the seesaw and say, we are so right, these craft are the heavenly sign of the second coming. Not the religionists who are sectarian and have given us so many wars because they have distorted spiritual truth. A great difference between those two. On the other side of the seesaw, in which the earnest investigator of these is trying to keep his feet firmly on the central strong point of that seesaw in making his assessments, You have the ultra-realists who say nuts and bolts or nothing, and by heaven, for 22 years, they have got nothing. So you get the two crank fringes. So dangerous to come from that beautiful balancing central point of earnest endeavor for truth to that point which wants the craft to land, which wants to know the propulsion method, so it can then give the secret to the world's maniacal groups who will then blast those poor souls from their planet. You can see, of course, why they would not give us their secrets. On the other hand, the holy Joes and the cheerless Jills who say, well, the world's going to end very soon and we're all going to be blasted. Isn't it lovely? No. But isn't it far better to keep into that seesaw on the center and to say, I dismiss the cranks there, I dismiss the cranks there, but the open-minded scientist who is here, nearer, and the open-minded spiritual people who are on the ball too, mark my words, take the best from that world and take the best from that world and ignore the fringe area, then if one is earnestly seeking truth and has forgotten materialism, corruption, and the other things, over-commercialization of this subject, then one must get to a central focus point of truth. Not only about the craft, about who or whatever is aboard the craft, and what their purpose must be in coming in ever-increasing numbers into our atmosphere. But until the ego is absolutely dwarfed, not only that, decimated perhaps, no individual will ever grasp the truth that they hold for us. The evidence, and I'm not going to relate too much, but the corroborative evidence that we have at this time from various parts of the world, from that inner group, the truly spiritual people, and that inner group, the open-minded scientific people and not the fringe areas. This leads us to believe, and this is what the theme of this talk is UFOs and modern thinking, modern thought. It leads us to believe very, very deeply that the next decade could lead to a new type of age for man on Earth. The evidence is so patent and weighty to us. It probably is to so many people in the world who try to keep to that central point of the seesaw. It may be that parts of our Earth will suffer geophysical disaster. That could be. But if you just think, as a humanist alone perhaps, of the terrible evils, the stockpiling of enough nuclear warheads now in America alone to blast this Earth off the map 30 times. At Porton, quite near Warminster, that probably has significance, of course, enough chemical nerve gas agents alone to kill our world off 9 times over, if that's possible. The Russians dumping 25,000 tons of mustard gas into Danish fishing waters, gas that was never used in World War II. There are so many obvious dangers, physical dangers, in our atmosphere, beneath our ground, in our seas, in the ways of chemical pollution, of atomic fissionable material which is disposed as waste undersea. It only needs one igniting point, one combustible factor, and this Earth could be blown apart, and the Earth's atmosphere could become a living inferno of fire. Don't have to be a scientist to work this out, and you certainly don't have to be an egotist. It's all there. So many things are there. And we suspect very strongly that at Warminster, as probably in other very salient parts and important parts of this globe at this time. At Warminster, at a place called Heaven's Gate, there exists what our scientists would term a time warp. This is a window, or a gate if you like, which allows two dimensions to converge, to meet, and even, perhaps, to communicate. It could be that the greatest power of all uses this other dimension as his dominion. It's the ultimate dimension. And if it's mixing with ours at this time, there's a theory about a unified field theory. Put it in this way. Let us assume that we are on the doorstep, on the threshold of the fourth dimension. That there are seven dimensions in store, or that we can possibly, given the right impetus, the right self-will, and the right selflessness, we can get eventually to at that seventh dimension. If we are in the fourth, and I put this to you at the moment as just a hypothetical thing, but it shows one can expand then perhaps to the more true, straight vision of what is in store for man, if he's sensible. Supposing that the fifth and the sixth dimensions at this particular point in time are very concerned about the behavior and the state and the potential menace of the fourth, to which we're entering. Therefore, before they can make any move to help, to come into our atmosphere, to do certain things which will stop the rot setting in finally, they knock on the door of the seventh dimension, the ultimate. And they ask permission of the seventh to do certain things in the world of the fourth, because unification of all dimensions is so important in the collective whole of universal man. It doesn't matter what planetary system he's on. Supposing this were true, perhaps in a year or so we may be able to prove that it could be true. The fifth and the sixth, who are more advanced, more evolved, not only technologically, but of course their moral, cultural, and social impetus has gained at the same time. Ours hasn't. They are desperately worried about us, because each dimension depends on the healthiness of all others, whether one retrogresses back into the first, second, third, immaterial. They have their standard points of evolution. And the seventh dimension, which is the dimension of the great power which no man can fight against, no man can fight against, love. True love. If man could only understand that, and not be so suspicious, so hostile, so still digging his heels in this primordial mud from which we apparently came in the beginning. If man could only evolve to that little extent, really, it doesn't need an awful lot of effort, to say that love, not in the sexual, physical sense, in the most beautiful sense of all, true concern for all, doesn't matter which dimension the others are in. That force, which is in that seventh dimension, is the one that gives all blessings and all riches of spirit. It gives all seeds of proper evolution when asked. Now, at Warminster, we had all sorts of what we thought was apparently a negative force at work, all sorts of peculiar things happening on our hill, at Star Hill, at Lord's Hill, at God's Hill, which is quite close, and at Heaven's Gate. Funny names, aren't they? Jacob's Ladder is there too. We had, and this we were desperately worried about because we get so many good, sincere souls on our hill. We were very worried that this force was one which intended to intimidate, to frighten, to bewilder, and to push people away. Cameras. Film replaced wrong way round in canisters. A tape recorder. Components stripped down in a matter of seconds and laid in reverse order on the casing. Even a dear old soul's knitting woolen needles turned the wrong way round. These things worried us. Disappearing things worried us because we feel a little bit responsible as a team for people coming onto our hill. We're so glad when they see something inexplicable. We were blaming discarnate entities or disembodied entities or poltergeists, call it what you like, of the negative factor in the whole of life, subastral planes perhaps. We were blaming that type of force quite seriously for this back to front sort of misbehavior mentioned in my last book, and I'm not plugging that. But in retrospect, I think there was a message from the positive, from the concrete, from the love force of the universe, which is expressed in so many ways from the sun alone. Surely we've heard, for example, of Philip Rogers, who has space music, allegedly, and space messages on a tape recorder, not on record, but on playback, the reverse order. So, juvenile again, as usual, as we have to be, perhaps, in the beginning, here's a new puzzle, something which perplexes, something which is beginning to frighten. We look in a mirror, literally, tape recorder here, put it on to record, in there, playback. There is the image or the likeness. Watch, hold it in front of the mirror, juvenile again, elementary. The hands of the watch are going in that mirror in an anti-clockwise direction. What do the opposites mean? Now, surely one of the lessons is this. There's nothing wrong with our science if it's open-minded science. There's nothing wrong with people on this planet if instead of being so dogmatic, so physical, we're the real, that's my shadow in the mirror sort of attitude. If they only unbend and become illogical instead of logical, irrational occasionally instead of rational, unrealistic instead of ultra-realistic, then they match up with something out there. Sounds ridiculous. But this is what we think, quite seriously, in retrospect, is true. And what they're telling us is, man is built in an image or a likeness of the greatest force in the universe, the force of creation. He is built in the likeness or the image. And that force, that beautiful creative force of everything which is positive, loving, generous, life-giving, light-giving, that is invisible. Our culprits in the cars, disorganizing, turning things back to front, invisible force. The air, we can't do without breath. Invisible. Perhaps, you see, we are so realistic that we say, here's me, this is the physical, I'm strong. There's no one stronger than I, and this is it. Here are my muscles to prove it. Perhaps we've got too far into that dogmatic attitude. not realizing that the invisible elements in the whole of nature, the whole of creation, the whole of the cosmos and the universe are the important, strong things. The sun pushes out its rays. It gives us light, life, warmth, everything conducive to growth. Those rays are invisible unless striking cloud or solid formation. When they are reflected, they show reflection. I can have a wireless set here, I'll calibrate it to a certain wavelength, and I'll get music from Tokyo, 3,000 miles away. But the force that's giving me that beautiful music from 3,000 miles away, even though if I were in a padded cell, which is probably where I belong in a lot of people's estimation, if one was in a cell with 6 inches thickened steel around one, one will still get that beautiful music if one has this calibration at this end. And the invisible force, it's not tangible, it's not something you can touch. That beautiful link from you, from Tokyo to you, which is coming across on one of these wonderful currents of power in the universe, which man doesn't see, but which is. We call it electricity. It has a very much higher conception, very much higher value than that, of course. The strength, the untold treasury, if only man deserved to find the secrets of ultrasonics, atomic resonance, supersonics, the power of color and sound. Levitation for the birds. Easily done. Birds do it, don't they? You see, they have a certain portion of a power that we do not yet possess. The invisible things, then. Here are my hands. There are your chairman's hands. I hope you don't think I'm being personal. There are your hands. Each one of you has his and her separate type of talent, which, used sensibly, provides the economic means whereby we all live. Hands, part of the physique. I can build you a house of bricks with these. I can build your highways with these. I can build all the material things that you want with these. The clothing that you wear, the jewelry that you wear, the spectacles that you wear, the televisions that you like to look at. I can build. But think. Mind over matter. It doesn't go deep enough. Mind gives birth to matter. We're getting nearer. Here, within here, is the brain, of course, the vibrationary grey cells. One can measure to a certain extent the electrical output of those. The electrical output from one's fingertips or extremities. One knows that here one has an electrical voltage field. Man is an electrical component physically. But this mind, the creative thought through which these hands must work, is not measurable. It's still invisible. Creative thought is invisible. But like the reflection in the mirror, it's an image, it's a likeness of the great invisible force of all in the whole universe. The great expression of love and terrific, enormous energy for the good of all man. Whether we call that energy God, whether we call it nature, matters not. Doesn't matter at all. This is the sort of conclusion we are rather hesitantly, and that's understandable being hard professional people, this is the sort of truth we are arriving at, perhaps just in one little place called Warminster. We know that physically, scientifically, Warminster has an abnormal electromagnetic field. It hasn't, this has been proven, measured. we know that many peculiar things happen, that the shape of the tumuli, the burial barrows on the ground, equate to the three main types of UFO that we see. We know that certain types we can photograph, and therefore we would hazard a shrewd guess that these are the extraterrestrials. They do come from other planets. The other type, the lights, the inexplicable light formations which the cameras don't capture, could they belong to an interpenetrating, invisible world of ours which holds the real balance of power? You see what I'm driving at? We are the physical ones on our planet. And we often, collectively and journalistically, of course, we say, well, why on earth don't the extraterrestrials come to us? But is the truth, the humbling truth, the fact that they cannot come to us? They have to go to the real rulers, the wise ones of long ago, the wise ones of today and possibly the future, that we might develop into those wise ones. The invisible force which rules our planet, which is a vibrant, invisible, untouchable, but such a strong part of that seventh dimension. Now, I won't wander on any more. I'm often accused on the hill of rabbiting, but people find it makes the time go on, and it's very pleasant to meet them all. But I'll leave you with this one thought. What man thinks today, he becomes tomorrow. So that if one concentrates on real concern for all, knowing that all others are as one is, therefore the collective ego is a thing of beauty, the individual ego is not necessary, identity is not necessary. When one has that positive view of everything, then obviously the dangers with which we are surrounded and which are among us physically, as we know, as I've just lightly touched upon, chemical agents, atomic fissionable material in seed, terrible things which are waiting to be ignited by one blunder only, the positive side, the more we show of that, the less we try to fight love, because you can't fight love. The more we give love, then the quicker we move not only into and out of the fourth, into the fifth and the sixth, but to the ultimate. And I still think, and here I bring ego in for once, I still think that we shall not end up as mummified eggs on Saturn. I just can't conceive. I think in the final analysis, this needs a terrific amount of moral courage to go forward in a new spirit, in the spirit of this new age, ready to accept everything, providing one can differentiate here. This is chaff. I don't want that. This is real grain. I want this. This is the dross. I don't want that. This is the real gold of this. I want that. When one gets to that stage, I don't think that these flying visitors of ours will ever need to bother us again, if one puts the term bother into this concept. But I think that one will always welcome them, and the quicker this unity comes between us, the quicker we elevate ourselves again from selfless motive, from non-egotism, to the true dimensions, the worlds within worlds, the beauty of all life and its purpose. Thank you very much.